I'm Vanessa Bealey, independent investigative journalist, based in Damascus, Syria, for the last, this is my third year. Although, of course, I've been coming to Syria to cover events on the ground here since 2016, and prior to that, in 2013, 2012, living in, well, spending extensive time in Gaza, Palestine.
Yeah, well, I think of Syria almost like the road to Damascus. And some people have even talked about it as Stalingrad in the Second World War, which was where the Western ambition to basically balkanize the Middle East, etc., was brought to a halt, largely with Russian help. But can you just tell us your family? Because you have a family connection to the country, don't you?
Not so much to Syria, but to the Middle East in general. My father, Harold Bealey, was probably, or he's known as one of the most iconic sort of Arabists of his time, involved as Middle East advisor to Ernest Bevin, who, of course, that was the very slim window where the British government did, or members of the British government did, actually try to push back against the Truman Doctrine to settle Jews in Palestine. And then, of course, the Stern Gang got involved. My father was actually caught up in all of that, as was Ernest Bevin and various other members of the government or my father's peers. But he continued to support the Palestinian cause for all of his career and then all of his life after he retired. He was British ambassador in Egypt, Cairo. First of all in 1957, and then he was called back in 67 by Gamal Abdel Nasser as the only peace envoy that Nasser trusted to come and deal with the situation at that point in 67. I suppose I absorbed an interest in the Middle East through osmosis, through lunchtime
Well, I mean, these are the
conversations.
days of something called pan-Arabism. You know, this is the idea that the Arab nations were going to have to unite in order to contain Israel effectively. I mean, there were other aspects to it, but that was the idea in those days. And that was all kind of, I suppose, due to the activities of the Western Intelligence Service. I remember reading years ago, I think it was called The Game of Nations, a book by Miles Copeland, was it?
Yeah, who
Who
was
was
a
the
friend of
CIA
my
station chief
father.
in Egypt.
Yeah.
Sorry?
He was a colleague of my father's, yes.
Because he was interesting. He was a CIA station chief in Cairo, but he was also quite a good guy. The idea was after he'd retired, he decided, look, I want to expose the way that the Central Intelligence Agency has been operating in the Middle East. And of course, then there were things like the Arab-Israeli wars and the Six-Day War in 1967, as everyone was jumping around to the Beatles and stuff. You know, there was this horrific war. And then I think it was 73, the October War, the Yom Kippur War, which really sealed the fate of the Pan-Arab Alliance and kicked the Arabs out of Jerusalem, etc. So, you know, you have yourself there drawn a sort of line between the plight of the Palestinians and what's happened in Syria. Is it fair to link the two, do you think?
Yeah, of course. I mean, one of the main reasons that the US has waged this regime change war since 2011, although of course it was incubated for decades before that. And in fact, I recently documented the 75 years, which is still conservative, of CIA and MI6 interventions and interferences in Syrian state affairs from 1946 onwards, when of course Syria was declared its independence from the French mandate, post Sykes-Picot, post Balfour Agreement, etc., etc. But one of the reasons that successive Syrian presidents have either been removed or have been or have had attempts against their governments, like Hafez al-Assad, the father of Bashar al-Assad, is because of their loyalty to the Palestinian cause and to the resistance organizations that have as their lifelong battle, of course, to free Palestine from the Zionist occupation. And of course, that includes Iran and Hezbollah. And then, of course, the long-term relationship and alliance between formerly the Soviet Union, now, of course, Russia, that has been a thorn in the side, particularly of Britain. You know, as Peter Ford, the former British ambassador to Syria, I think in 2003 to 2006, he has always said, you know, the British policy towards Syria is even more vindictive than that of the US. And that's basically down to the Syrian relationship with Russia, as it is now, but of course, as I said previously, with the Soviet Union. And many of the interventions carried out by CIA and MI6, which of course started from 1946 onwards, in fact, from the very creation of the CIA, which was a rebranding of the US intelligence agencies. That's effectively what has been the sort of main reason for those attempts to, or successful attempts in some cases, to remove elected Syrian governments that were pro-Russia and, in their view, of course, pro-communist.
Well, it's all very well sort of being interested in and studying and reading about and having it, a bit of it in your family, you know, an interest in Damascus, Syria, the Arab world, Vanessa, but why move there?
That's a good question. I think throughout my time here, I felt a very strong connection to the people of this country. And I mean, you know, very much myself and Eva Bartlett have spent considerable time, particularly in the areas formerly occupied by the terrorist groups, funded and sponsored, of course, by the West and their allies in the Gulf states and Israel, et cetera, and Turkey. And grown very fond of the people here. Their resourcefulness, resilience. I mean, you know, if you look at Syria now, and now it's suffering under the all, you know, the doubling down of economic pressure, the blockade, the besieging of people, the occupation of their own resources, particularly the US occupation of the oil fields, the burning of wheat fields, the burning of barley, the theft of agricultural produce. So, you know, they are effectively being strangled and suffocated. And of course, in a sense, the war itself, a military war itself, is easier to deal with than the effects of sanctions, which in my view are nothing less than economic terrorism, but which are a silent death. And it's not one that you can escape from. You can try to escape from mortars and missiles and occupation and imprisonment, but you can't escape from the economic pressure that's now being brought to bear upon the Syrian people. So I don't, you know, in short, I love this country and I love the people. And I feel a lot more comfortable here than I do in the West, which in my view is responsible for the bloodshed and suffering in this country.
But I agree with you. I was brought up in London and, you know, I kind of never felt quite at home. I always felt it was a bit of a cutthroat place. And, you know, the city particularly was a place I used to see people on trains commuting into Cannon Street, you know, every morning coming back looking as if they'd had some sort of blood transfusion or something. So they looked even more grey than in the morning. And there's something sort of wrong about London, really, deeply wrong, which is why I got out, I suppose. But look, you know, what is life like there? Because I understand now that the Russians, although they are in control of the airspace, they're actually allowing, I don't know how or why, but they are saying to the Israelis, well, it's okay, you can come in and bomb Hezbollah if you feel like it from time to time. And so long as you run it past us first, we're up for that. So what is life like now under this situation where, you know, you may get bombed by the Israelis still, even though the war is supposed to be over, the Russians are supposed to have won?
Well, I would disagree, first of all, that the Russians have won. I would say that the Syrian Arab Army is the mainstay of the military campaign here. The Russians, as you know, only intervened in September 2015 when the Syrian Arab Army was fighting on, I think I was recently told, it was well over 100 fronts. Of course, that is now reduced down now to around, I think it's around a figure of 20 fronts, different fronts. And of course, now they have the support of the Russian military and Russian Air Force. I would also disagree. I would outright state that that is Israeli propaganda, that Russia has agreed that they can target Hezbollah or Iranian positions inside Syria. On a number of occasions, Lavrov and other officials have made it quite clear that they do not agree with the targeting, particularly when that targeting has led, which it has in many cases, to civilian deaths, of course. And of course, you know, this sort of this Israeli or Zionist canard of preemptive self-defense strikes is absolute nonsense. And I can tell you myself, I mean, from the moment that Putin signed off on the independence of Lugansk and Donetsk, we had three attacks from Israel in 1 week, which is unprecedented. And all of those attacks were targeting Syrian Arab Army bases, Syrian Arab Army air defenses. And where I live, I'm about 2 kilometers from one of the biggest air defense bases to the west of Damascus. That was targeted. Various air bases to the south and to, sorry, I'm just working it out in my head, to the northwest were targeted in Homs. And even prior to the Ukraine issue, Israel had upped its attacks on not on Iranian bases or Hezbollah bases, but on effectively Syria's capability to defend itself should Israel escalate the conflict. And certainly military experts here and analysts here believe that there is a very high risk of there being an escalation in the conflict with Israel in the very near future. So I would suggest that the fact that Israel is sort of picking off Syrian air defense, Syrian radar, Syrian air bases, Syrian, what do you call them, runways, military runways, for example, is in preparation for that escalation in the conflict. So I would negate the fact that Israel has claimed that Russia has given them permission to do so. And of course, there was also the bombing of Latakia port, which is the main entry point for goods, particularly foodstuffs from Russia, from Iran, but also oil from Iran, to break the siege and blockade that the US coalition has placed on Syria. It is true that in that case, for example, Israel had informed Russia of an incoming attack because, of course, there was a very high likelihood of there being Russian military planes in the air at that time, which in fact there were, and that was the reason that the Syrian air defense couldn't respond to the attack on that occasion. But I would also say, and again, it's not really reported in the media, either in Israeli media or in Western media, of course, but Russia quite frequently is actually up in the air, and it has been known to buzz the Israeli planes to turn them back if they're coming too close to the Syrian border. And remembering,
it might sound like an obvious question, Vanessa, but why don't the Syrians shoot these aircraft down if they're coming to do airstrikes on your country?
No, well, they don't actually. They rarely cross into Syrian airspace. The majority of them are coming in from Lebanese airspace. So you might ask why Hezbollah doesn't bring them down, but of course,
well, yeah,
you know, that's another issue. There was one instance where the missiles were actually fired from the region of the largest U.S. occupation military base in Al-Tanf on the border with Jordan. And of course, missiles have also been fired from the Mediterranean, from the sea, off the coast of...
just off the coast. Yeah, these are sort of standoff weapons where they just fire it and then they fly off. And but anyway, look, missiles aside, airstrikes aside, and it's good to be reminded that this is going on because it's not being reported, as you say. What is, you know, day-to-day life like in Damascus?
I would say in the last, really since the whole sort of COVID project kicked off in 2020, things have plummeted to dreadful levels of suffering here. Raging inflation, which the government is just about keeping a grip on. Lebanon's actually now far worse than Syria from that perspective. Crippling economic sanctions. While, of course, providing, you know, while the armed groups that still exist in the northwest, in Idlib, the largest al-Qaeda haven since 9/11, according to Brett McGurk, Ambassador Jeffries admitted that al-Qaeda is a U.S. asset in the northwest. But the humanitarian aid that is coming there bypasses all of the sanctions imposed upon the government-held areas of Syria, of course. and all the NGOs, all the UN agencies can provide aid and humanitarian assistance. And as we know, finance organizations that are affiliated to the terrorist groups in those terrorist-held areas, while the 85% of Syria that is back under the control of the Syrian government is deprived entirely. On top of that, of course, you have, under Trump, you had the sort of what I called the scorched earth policy, which was where literally the American troops were dropping thermal balloons on the agricultural areas in the northeast. In the south, Israel was actually taking part in the burning of the crops there. The terrorist groups themselves have occupied many of the olive plantations, the cotton growing areas, even stolen the apiaries, the beekeeping equipment and so on, stealing agricultural equipment, effectively destroying the ability of the Syrian people to be self-sufficient. And most of all, of course, occupying the oil fields in the northeast, which is providing income for U.S. proxies, including ISIS, but also including the Kurdish Contras, the separatists, and also providing trade and economy for al-Qaeda, who've established their own monopoly on processing the oil and then trading it to Turkey. And of course, Turkey, as we know, has been trading it to Israel since really the beginning of the war against Syria. So here, in all honesty, I mean, the electricity has just gone off. Here where I am in a Damascus suburb, I have 5 hours off, 1 hour on. So effectively, I have about 3 hours electricity every day. That means that many of the apartment buildings can't get water to their tanks, which are on the roof. We don't have fuel. Benzene, as it's called here. Prices of fuel have skyrocketed, and quite often we'll have 2 or 3 days where people are queuing incessantly to try and put 20 litres in their car. Food prices, again, have gone up, I think, around 1,000%. I mean, it's crazy. The average family here, the average government employee earns 70,000 Syrian pounds, which is equivalent now to about $20. So if you imagine 70,000 Syrian pounds, 2 kilos of chicken, no, 4 kilos of chicken is around 50.
Sorry, is that a week? A week?
No,
a month,
that's a
what?
Month. That's a month.
Okay.
4 kilos of chicken is 50,000. So, you know, it doesn't take much to figure out that people here, at least 85% of the population, are below the poverty line. Apartment rents have gone through the roof. Many people are leaving. And, of course, that's that's another kind of standard MO of these hideous sort of neoconservative wars that have been waged against the region, is that, of course, it drives out the middle class. It drives out the educated people that can afford to leave the country and that can find prospects in other countries and, of course, are welcomed into other countries. That means the doctors, the dentists, the nurses, the researchers, the analysts, etc., right? So the country is really, really suffering. And, of course, very few people are paying much attention to it right now.
Well, yes, there's lots of reasons. People seem to be being distracted with Ukraine. But what do you make of what's going on there? Is there any connection, do you think, with the US and Western policies in the Middle East to balkanize the Middle East, soften up the Middle East, et cetera, to what's going on in Eastern Europe now?
Yeah, I do think there is a connection. and in fact, President Assad, immediately after the Russian military operation began, made the point that, you know, Russia, having joined Syria in the fight against Islamic terrorism, is now fighting against Nazism in Ukraine. But of course, that isn't the only connection. The other connection is the intention of NATO member states, of course, dominated by the United States, to effectively blockade Russia on its western flank. Had they invaded the Donbass region, which apparently they were about to, which is what precipitated the Russian incursion, then, of course, Russia would have had NATO proxies right on its border with the potential of further annexation of territory or invasion or the use of chemical weapons. As we've discovered, there are, or we haven't discovered, I mean, it's been reported for actually a number of years that there are 11 biolabs run by the United States State Department in Ukraine in partnership with Ukrainians.
Well, we were hearing actually from Diliana Kataschova last week, Vanessa, that she thinks at least 13. There are apparently, in a hearing yesterday with Victoria Nuland, it looks like there may be even more bioweapons labs. It's funny because they say they're just research laboratories, but they're Pentagon funded. And of course, the Pentagon may well fund civil research that's nothing to do with the military at all.
No. I mean, Diliana has done extensive work. I'm glad you had her on. I'm actually talking to her next week on the fact that they've experimented on, I think it's more than 5,000 Ukrainian troops. They've been developing pathogens. They've been developing methods to deliver those pathogens and those viruses potentially into Russia. And then, of course, there was also the threat of the development of nuclear weapons. And something interesting that I found today, actually, that in January 2021, Zelensky signed a law on indigenous peoples, which effectively segregated the Russian-speaking Ukrainians out of the equation. So in my view, that is effectively opening the door to an ethnic cleansing program by the Azov neo-Nazi or fascist factions within the Ukrainian army and political institutions.
Well, that's very naughty of him, isn't it? Because he was elected on the platform of actually making peace with the Russian-speaking parts and the Donetsk and Lugansk particularly.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, since 2014, the genocide, which has been ongoing in Donetsk and Lugansk and the Donbass region, which is separate to, because the Donbass region, as Eva Bartlett explained to me today, is partly occupied by the Ukrainian forces. And then obviously the separatist side is on the other part. And that includes Donetsk and Lugansk. And those 14,000 victims have, of course, been literally largely disappeared from the discourse in the West, as of course have Russia's perfectly legitimate concerns about NATO expansion east, particularly in view of their violation of the Minsk agreement. So there were a number of things that I think made it unacceptable for Russia to maintain the status quo, and of course the threat that Ukraine would join NATO, and then of course he would have a bona fide NATO nation on his border.
But surely, Vanessa, look, Putin is just a bad loser. He's been trying to persuade the Ukrainian people to side with Russia and be friends with Russia. Actually, what they've decided is, no, we're not interested in Russia. The Ukrainian people have decided to go with the EU, the West, and not quite with NATO yet, but certainly with the EU and the Western alliance. And he's just a bad loser.
Well, I don't think that you can say the entire Ukrainian people, because you have Donetsk and Lugansk that definitely do not want to be a part of NATO or EU or of the right-wing neo-Nazi elements that are being reinforced by NATO nation states. There was evidence that the UK were training the National Guard. There's evidence that Canada is involved and collaborating with them. And in the same way, the parallels between Syria and what's happening in the Ukraine are glaring, added to the fact that now at least 450 terrorist mercenaries, 300 from Idlib, the 150 others are of mixed nationality, majority being European, Chechen, Uyghurs, have been dispatched via Turkey, another NATO member state, into the Ukraine to fight alongside the neo-Nazi brigades, followed, of course, potentially by the White Helmets, who made a statement that they are ready to go and assist the Ukrainian people. So I think, no, saying that Putin is a sore loser, Putin is one of the steadiest statespeople. I mean, we've never seen him react in a precipitative way. If you remember when Turkey brought down the Russian jet over Syrian airspace, Russia kept very quiet on that. They didn't take revenge as most people would expect countries in the West to do. And I think, even under international law, what Putin has done to protect his national security is entirely legitimate. As Christopher Black, who is an international lawyer, has argued in his most recent article. And from the perspective of Syria, as I've mentioned, the historic alliance between Russia and Syria, and of course the blockading of Russia, particularly on that western flank, the taking control of Ukraine, which is known to be the breadbasket of Europe, it has vast agricultural, coal, mineral, oil resources, would essentially mean that Russia would be unable to come to the aid or to bypass the sanctions in Syria. So to a large degree, the war against Syria has now, in my view, switched to Ukraine. The people of Ukraine, although many of them are Russian speaking, and many of those Russian speakers, as I've said, have been racially segregated by Zelensky under his law 1616 from January 2021. The people of Donbass, Donetsk and Lugansk have been under attack since 2014 when the Newland orchestrated regime change happened. And of course, let's not forget the massacre in Odessa. I don't think you can with a broad brush say these are the Ukrainian people. I'm sure that the majority of the Ukrainian people also do not want to see a burgeoning Nazi or neo-Nazi fascist element growing in strength under NATO's direction, control, funding, arming, as they've attempted to do in Syria with the Islamist extremists there. And I think, you know, I think Russia is quite within its rights to say we want a neutral Ukraine. We want the denazification. We want these extremist elements removed from Ukraine and not given power by NATO because they are a threat to Russia. And I think that that's perfectly legitimate. I don't think it's anything to do with being a poor loser. Russia has consistently attempted to negotiate their way to security, and NATO has consistently not only ignored but actually derided those attempts.
Well, maybe now the boots on the other foot, they might have to actually start thinking about talking, even though these economic sanctions have been piled on in this. I mean, it really seems incredible that
yeah, it's insane.
It's almost like, you know, everywhere in the country has got, including our central government, policies on equalities. But now it's OK to hate Russians. It doesn't matter even if they're wealthy, if they're not very wealthy, if they're Russian, then they can come in now for a bit targeted. But look, switching back to Damascus, I mean, obviously conditions there are pretty rough. How difficult does it have to get? How much do these economic sanctions and economic warfare have to bite in Syria for you to say, well, I've had enough, I'm going to get on a plane back to London?
Well, I think with the sanctions that have now been that are now targeting Russia, unfortunately, I think the blowback is going to be pretty painful for people in Europe and even in the UK. Whereas here, you know, as I said, I celebrate the resilience and resourcefulness of the Syrian people. And to some degree, I've learned to be very similar. So I've got used to not having electricity. I've got used to not having fuel. I've got used to paying higher prices for foodstuffs, etc. But all of this is coming to the West. As I said, during the COVID project, you know, the hybrid war that has been waged against countries like Syria is going to come back to bite the EU, to bite the UK, and to bite the US. And, you know, I think you yourself mentioned the fact that the war against Russia or the pressure on Russia was very much related also to the Nord Stream and to Germany. And so therefore, you know, this is a sort of, this is the fight between multipolarity and unipolarity, in my view. You know, we've lived in a world that is entirely dominated by the United States, and we've seen what that has done. It's destroyed how many countries in the Middle East, in South America. It's destroyed Palestine. it's breathed power into the Zionist entity. And it's been nothing but destructive, tyrannical. It's taken control of the UN. And I think, you know, the world, we need a world which is multipolar. And I think actually the majority of the EU countries would actually prefer that, were they able to actually give an opinion.
What's the best way for people to follow your work online, Vanessa? And also, maybe you could just recommend us with some news sites to follow what's going on in Syria, because we're getting pretty much nothing here from the London media.
One of the best ones is Syriana Analysis, which is, he's got, it's Kevork Almasyan. He's a Syrian based in Berlin. But he has his own YouTube channel and his own Patreon account. Obviously, Eva Bartlett is still covering events in Syria, although she's now based in Russia. Me, you can follow at my Patreon, which hasn't been shut down yet, surprisingly. I still have a YouTube channel, but I sync everything now to Odyssey because, of course, the censorship sweep is also, it, well, it was incredible during COVID. Now it's getting even more savage during the kind of Russian-Ukraine-NATO crisis. On Syria, I'm just trying to think of any others that are actively still covering it. There's not that many, actually. There's Mark Taliano in Canada, who's still paying attention. Sharmeen Nawani has launched a new media outlet called The Cradle. And she does have very good coverage from local journalists, regional journalists on regional events. Marwa Osman, of course, who's with Press TV. That's as many as I can think of, so I apologize profusely to anyone I've forgotten who's listening.
What about, you know, the sort of bigger news outlets like Internet, Middle East Monitor, the Middle East Memo or something? I'm not sure. There are some that do actually...
Yeah, Middle East Monitor is not bad. Al Monitor. Middle East Eye has the occasional, but... They all tend to be a bit skewed towards the mainstream narratives, but they're not bad. You can at least get some balance. I mean, Peter Oborn, who's been to Syria quite a few times and who's actually been very balanced in his reporting. Oh, of course, there's Stephen Kinzer. But Stephen Kinzer, who's based in Canada, I think, but he works for with mainstream media.
That's a fantastic bunch of bookmarks there for us, Vanessa. But anyway, thanks very much for joining us on your From Damascus. Thank you.
You're welcome, Tony. Take care.